What I would like to do in these 2 hours is to begin with Acts chapter 17 as a jump-off for broader reflections on preaching the gospel to biblical illiterates with a worldview very different from yours. So although I begin with exposition, in fact, in due course, our peregrinations will take us to farther fields, and then in the last half of the second session, we'll open it up to questions and comments. Let us begin by reading Acts chapter 17, beginning at verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them, that is Silas and Timothy mentioned in the preceding verse, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with both Jews and God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to debate with him. Some of them asked, "What is this babbler trying to say?" Others remarked, "He seems to be advocating foreign gods." They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we would like to know what they mean." All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship. And this is what I am going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in temples built by human hands. And he is not served by human hands, as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. From one man he made all the nations, that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by human design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance. But now he commands all people everywhere to repent. For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead." When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered. But others said, "We want to hear you again on this subject." At that, Paul left the council. Some of the people became followers of Paul and believed. Among them was Dionysius, a member of the Areopagus, also a woman named Damaris, and a number of others. This is the word of the Lord. Well, let's begin with the challenges Paul faces. Verse 16. He faces pluralism, in particular, pluralistic idolatry. You have to remember that Paul, after all, was an educated sophisticate. As far as we know, this was his first trip to Athens. Athens had been around for centuries. You could see Corinthian columns that were already half a millennium old. I remember when I first visited the UK. I came in 1972, a Canadian boy. And suddenly I was in Cambridge. St. Bennet's Church there was about 1,100 years old. 1,100 years old. In the United States, something is considered antique if it's 100 years old. So, suddenly to be surrounded by architecture and to visit the room where Erasmus worked on his New Testament in Queen's College, and to walk into Emmanuel College Chapel, designed by Sir Christopher Wren, and visit the library there, the second best Puritan library in the world, and on and on. It was a bit mind-boggling. But here Paul visits Athens, and instead of saying, my, this really does have some interesting historic roots, you ought to see those Corinthian columns, he is analyzing the culture Christianly. And he is distressed by the idolatry. In other words, at very least, what this text calls us to do is to analyze our culture, any culture we visit, Christianly. So that even when we see, when we gladly acknowledge the fruit of common grace in great buildings, great libraries, great learning, great science, great architecture, at the end of the day, where there is great pluralism and great idolatry, there should also be great distress. Someone brought up, of course, in a strong Jewish culture, is already committed to monotheism and works and thinks and lives and breathes and moves within that heritage. But in the Greco-Roman world, it was different. There were many, many gods, many, many philosophies, many, many races, many, many cultures, many, many languages. And to sort out what part of this you should rejoice in for the diversity of people that God has made, and what part you should lament over because it reflects rebellion against God, it takes time and thought and discernment, care. Paul sees the idols. Moreover, you can't help but recall how the idolatry worked. You recall that in the Old Testament, when regional superpowers like Assyria or Babylon took over a country, they often captured the aristocracy and the priests and the educated and the like and transported them elsewhere. And then they would capture similar people from some other country and bring them into the first country, and then there would be intermarriage and so on. So that the exile begins, the northern tribes about 721, the southern tribes about 586, precisely because those were imperial policies. It wasn't just that the Jews were transported, the Moabites were and the Ammonites were and so on, so on, so on. And it was partly because most countries had a kind of threefold string, a threefold cord: gods, people, and land. So the gods were associated with the people in the land. The people belonged to the land and to these gods. So if you could break that threefold cord, then there would be less likelihood of rebellion. So one of the reasons why you transported the people is you got them away from the land, and thus from the local gods. Besides that, these were the leaders, and if you made them dirt farmers somewhere 300 miles away, 500 miles away, in the case of Babylon, 700 miles away, then there was much less likelihood of the peasants who were left behind actually engaging in rebellion. The big disadvantage of this, of course, is that It breaks up your tax base. Your most productive people are being transported and have to start all over again. And so eventually, when the Medo-Persians took over from the Babylonians, realizing that it wasn't a very good way of producing lots of taxes for the empire, they allowed people to go home again. So it wasn't just the Jews at the end of the exile who were allowed to go home. The Moabites went home, and the Ammonites went home, and all the rest. In God's providence, he fulfilled Jeremiah's prophecies, and the people of God went home. But that still left the problem of rebellion. So what the Romans did, which is the regional superpower at this juncture, what the Romans did was, instead of moving people, they arranged for God swaps. When they took over any new area, they insisted that the local people adopt some of the gods in the Roman pantheon. And meanwhile, the Romans themselves adopted some of the gods from the local area. You had god swaps. That was imperial policy. That meant that if there was rebellion, it would not be entirely clear whose side which god was on, which broke the threefold cord in another way. So it was part of imperial policy, in other words, to foster rebellion. They made an exception in the case of Jews. They were considered so obstreperous and mean and nasty and hardcore in their silly monotheism that no god swap could be arranged in their case. But apart from that, god swaps was the imperial policy. So when Paul sees the idols in Athens, it's not just that there are a lot of little statues around. You're talking about a culture where everybody is a pagan, where there are loyalties to lots of different gods, and the loyalties shift and twitch and reshape themselves depending on which particular group they are, because the gods move around the empire with the god swaps, do you see? The Greco-Romans had thousands of gods. Nobody could know them all. Just as modern Hinduism has millions of gods, and nobody can know them all. And when you remember how Paul defines idolatry, when he says, for example, that greed is idolatry and covetousness is idolatry, idols, because what you want the most becomes god for you, then you realize that we too live in a culture of massive, complicated, pluralistic idolatry. What we want the most varies a great deal from sector to sector of our culture. We have a lot of idols, and we swap them around. They don't have to be little statuettes. They're simply what we want the most, because what we want the most controls our lives. What we want the most fires our imagination. What we want the most draws money from our pocketbooks. What we want the most occupies our time. It's what we think about. It's God for us. And then you marry that today with vague but increasing notions of spirituality, and you discover that this is not simply a world committed to philosophical materialism. It's a world committed to an idolatry of spiritualities that are complex and driving, controlling. Then, of course, you can't help but comment, before you look at the particulars, that this was a world of biblical illiteracy. When Paul is evangelizing in a synagogue, as in Acts chapter 13, then he has certain things in common with the people who are there. The people who are there may be Jews, so he's got a cultural, religious, racial heritage in common. But often, synagogues in the Greco-Roman world had a lot of God-fearers there too. People who were tired of the pluralism and of the idolatry and the paganism and were attracted to Judaism but weren't quite prepared to be circumcised and become Jews. A lot of God-fearers. So Paul had some things in common with them too. Monotheism. A belief that history was going somewhere. Not all cultures believe that. In Hinduism, history goes round and round and round. But in Jewish thought, in Christian thought, history has a telos. It's going somewhere. It comes from somewhere. There's an origin. and it's going somewhere, there's a final consummation. So there is a direction to history and a final accountability, a judgment at the end with God holding us to account. So there's judgment at the end. And then there is a real difference between right and wrong, and that right and wrong is tied to your religion. That is to say, in Greco-Roman world, you could be ever so religious, but it didn't necessarily have any connection with morality. But in Jewish thought, in Old Testament thought, in biblical thought, in Christian thought, spirituality is tied to morality. You can't separate the two. And then on top of that, right and wrong are defined in largely moral terms that are connected with the very character of God. In other words, not connected with an abstract system, but connected with the character of God. Whereas the gods of the Greco-Roman world were, morally speaking, more or less like human beings, only a little more souped up. So they got drunk and slept around and hated their parents and had affairs and incest. And these were the gods, do you see? So small wonder, therefore, that spirituality was not attached by the very character of God or the gods to a particular sort of conduct. But Paul has this in common with all the people in the synagogue, that morality is tied to the very character of God. That comes eventually from Old Testament terms. Do this, I am the Lord. Do that, I am the Lord. You shall love your neighbor as yourself, I am the Lord. Do you see? That's all given. That's all common. So that within that framework, salvation already consists of being reconciled to this God. Lostness is bound up in that world with being alienated from God because of guilt and sin. And salvation consists, in the first place, of being reconciled to that God. Somehow the sin is paid for. And, of course, in the Jewish heritage, because of the Old Testament antecedents, then that reconciliation to God turns on sacrifices. Blood sacrifices that God himself has ordained. You see, all of those things, and quite a number more that could be mentioned, were the common elements. Paul does not have to say anything at all about them. They're common assumptions. They're shared assumptions. So when he preaches the gospel in a place like a synagogue, then because those things are common, he spends no time on them. What he spends his time on in a sermon like the one we find in Acts chapter 13 is, who is Jesus? Is he truly the Messiah? Why did the Messiah have to die? We attest that he was risen from the dead. You see, all of the background structures into which Jesus fits are common. But now he finds himself in Athens, and none of the things that I've just mentioned are shared with his hearers. Not one. There is massive biblical illiteracy. And that is coming to the Western world. You're not as far down that path here in Northern Ireland as we are in Canada and the U.S. Not as far down that road as France is, but cheer up, you're catching up, you're getting there fast. In America, if you're in a Bible Belt part of the country, then there's still a lot of people with a fair bit of biblical data in their background. Not much synthetic thought, but at least some biblical data. But nevertheless, when I do university evangelism on an American campus or a Canadian campus or the like, the people with whom I'm dealing don't know the Bible has two testaments. They don't know the word Abraham. They've never heard of him. They have no idea how the Bible is put together. None. And even if they come from sort of Christianized homes, what they display is what the sociologist Christian Smith calls MTD. That's his abbreviation for therapeutic deism, moralistic, therapeutic deism, MTD. They're moralizing little legalists. They're deists, not theists. The God who is there is somehow far removed and doesn't have much to do with anything, but you can call him in an emergency, but he doesn't govern the affairs of things. You can't trust him for day-by-day life. That depends on you. And if he is concerned about you, basically, he wants you to be happy. God loves you and wants you to be happy. That's the therapeutic bit. So it's all about you and your happiness. That is so incredibly alien from anything that you say in the gospel. Where do you start? A few years ago, I was on a set, a television set. A film was being done for the Discovery Channel where they wanted a token evangelical to say something. So I was there for a couple of days. And during the couple of days that I was there, I made a point of talking to, I think, just about everyone on the crew, about 36 of them, and try to engage them in conversation and find out where they were and so on. I couldn't find one who knew the Bible had two testaments. Not one. And we were doing a religious program. There was one person, I make the exception, there was one person who knew the Bible had two testaments. She was the one who was supposed to be interviewing me. She introduced herself, bright and sparky, and said, I'm really enjoying this assignment. I've been reading now the Bible for about 6 weeks. I think I'm really getting good at it. I've got a handle on it now. Boy, was I impressed. And you realize once again, you know, that where you're sharing your faith to somebody who's on a different planet. This is the kind of thing that people in Northern Ireland would expect to do if you were suddenly called to become a missionary to Nepal. It's another world. But now that other world is here and growing. So that ordinary evangelism, outreach, bearing witness to the truth, is taking place in your hometown in a fashion analogous to Paul's ministry in Athens. So pluralism, biblical illiteracy, and then alien worldviews. We are told that there was a group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers who began to debate with him. Now, for us today, philosophy is an academic discipline in small departments in large universities of marginal significance for the rest of society. They're the sort of people you quietly poke fun at. But in the ancient world, philosophy was taken seriously. Philosophy meant something like what we mean by worldview. And so the various philosophies competed in the marketplace of ideas. There were several large labels and a lot of small ones, and there were no universities, but a lot of roving, traveling lecturers, thousands of them through the empire, who earned their bread by lecturing in the marketplace of ideas. And they tried to convince people that their philosophy was the best one because it showed you how to live. And their philosophy was not merely a set of moralizing rules, it was the way to understand the entire universe. So in this case, the Epicurean philosophers, the ideal of Epicureanism was an undisturbed life. It was predicated in the first instance on the assumption that human beings are made up of atoms so small that they live in the interstices of the atoms of the rest of the world. That is, in the spaces between the other atoms. That's where we live. And those atoms are so small that they don't interact with the larger world. So morally, as this works out, this means that we should aim to be undisturbed by the rest of the world and get on with our own business and not be troubled by undue involvement in human affairs. The gods themselves were composed of atoms so fine they live in the calmness and the spaces between the worlds. And as the gods are nicely removed from the hurly-burly of life, so human beings should seek the same kind of ideals. But as you read on in this paragraph, you discover that Paul, by contrast, presents a God who is actively involved in this world as its creator, It's providential ruler. It's judge. It's self-disclosing savior. That's a massive worldview clash. The Stoics, for their part, thought of the gods as all-pervasive. And they could switch in their writing between gods in the plural and God in the singular, which has seduced some Christians to thinking that basically deep down the Stoic philosophers were really monotheists. If monotheism is predicated on theism, that is belief in a personal transcendent God, they weren't monotheists. Because when they spoke of God in the singular, it was sort of godness rather than a personal God. God in a singular sense was more or less pantheistic, that is identified with all of reality. And to conduct life as a human ideal was to live in line with what was ultimately real, with this God or principle of reason which must rule over against emotion and passion. So Stoicism was marked by high moral endeavor and great sense of duty. But nevertheless, against this vision, the God that Paul presents, far from being pantheistic, identified with the rest of the universe, he is personal, distinct from the creation, the creator of everything else, and final judge. So instead of focusing on universal reason tapped into by human reasoning, which lay at the heart of Stoic religion philosophy, Paul contrasts divine will and sovereignty with human dependence and need. These are massive worldview structures. Do you see? Well, one could point out more things, but that's enough. The challenges Paul faces: idolatry, pluralism, biblical illiteracy, alien worldviews. Then second, the priorities Paul adopts. The priorities Paul adopts. We're told that he's greatly distressed. So what does he do? Verse 17. He reasoned in the synagogue with both Jews and God-fearing Greeks. Number two, also in the marketplace, day by day, with those who happened to be there. So he establishes as his priorities the primacy of preaching to those with a shared heritage. And then second, the urgency of preaching to those with an alien heritage. He does both. We don't have a sample of his sermon in the synagogue in Athens, but I'm sure it was like much of his preaching in other synagogues. The synagogues established a certain mindset. If you want to have an idea of the sort of things he said, then read what is the longest reported sermon in the book of Acts, namely the one in Acts 13, where he's preaching in a synagogue. That's the sort of thing that he could get away with, precisely because he was dealing with people with a shared heritage. Now, at this point, it's worth pausing just for a moment to deal with an issue that some of you might have thought of. I don't know if this particular stance troubles anybody in Northern Ireland, but in some parts of the world, people argue that in Acts 17, what you find is not a model of how to evangelize people in an alien culture. What you find is Paul making a mistake. The reasoning runs like this. Paul preaches here in Acts 17, and by the end of the chapter, what you discover is that only a few people believe. There's no great success. There's no mention of a church being fashioned in Athens. And then he moves on to Corinth, and as he reflects on his Corinthian experience later and writes to the Corinthians, he says, 1 Corinthians chapter 2, I determined among you not to know anything except Jesus Christ and him crucified. What he really is doing is saying, I gave up on all this philosophy bit. I just got back to the basic gospel. I made a mistake when I was in Athens up the road. I got it straight again, and once I got to Corinth, then I was finally back on track again. Are you familiar with this theory? Some of you, yes? And maybe some of you actually believe it. Well, I'm inviting you to repent. Let me give some reasons why it's a bad theory. Now, the only reason I'm doing this is not because I'm terribly interested in New Testament introduction. The reason I'm doing it is because you won't want to learn from Paul's practice here if you think that basically Paul got it wrong here. I want you to see that the book of Acts does not tell us that Paul got it wrong here. He got it right, and therefore we must learn from it. So this is more than an esoteric footnote. It's a necessary step to take to be sure that we're all on the same page in this respect. So let me give some reasons why this particular interpretation is really wrong-headed. Number one, it's not the natural reading of Acts. In other words, it's a construction that is made by putting Acts 17 and 1 Corinthians 2 together in a particular fashion. But when these books first circulated, of course, they weren't bound up as our Bibles are bound up. There was a scroll here and a scroll there. When somebody first read Acts, he couldn't start saying, I wonder how Paul looked on this in retrospect when he wrote to the Corinthians. I mean, they couldn't do that. So if you just read the book of Acts through, there is no flag in Acts 17 that says, up until now, Paul's been a pretty decent chap. Here he got it all wrong. You know, pay attention because you don't want to make the same mistakes. There's no flag in the book of Acts that tells you this. In other words, the interpretation is not a natural reading of Acts. Number two, we'll see in a few moments that Acts 17, what Paul actually says in the sermon, is actually entirely in line with his own theology expressed in the Epistle of the Romans. So that in the first chapters of Romans, Paul sets the stage for the atonement theology that reaches its high point in 3:21 to 26 by talking about God as the creator, the sovereign holy judge, the universality of sin and idolatry, and so on. Paul really establishes the same points, we'll see in a few moments, in Athens as he theologizes about in Romans. This is not Paul being alien and nastily philosophical. This is Paul communicating the same things that he always communicates, but in slightly different categories. Number three, Acts 17 does not say, as some of our translations have put it, that only a few believed. Verse 32, when they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, but others said, and so on. And on to the next two or three verses. The Greek says, tines de, certain people believed, and others, heteroi, out of relatively small numbers. The Areopagus wasn't a big crowd, and others did other things. Number four, transparently, Paul was cut off. You see, some people look at the Areopagus address and say, you know, he takes a long time to get to Jesus. If you're going to preach Jesus, you've got to get there a lot faster than that. And he doesn't actually mention the cross. He mentions the resurrection. He hasn't even got to the cross. He leaves out the most important bit. Small wonder then that he repents of all of this and says later, I resolve to know nothing among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified. Because that's exactly what he didn't do when he was in Athens. But transparently, Paul was cut off. He got to the resurrection and people started sneering and laughing and interrupting and saying, this guy's nuts. This doesn't make any sense at all. But if you want to know what Paul says in a pagan context, see what he was already saying to the pagans in the marketplace. We read verse 17. He reasoned in the synagogue with both Jews and God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. And when people started questioning him, and laughing at him and saying he seems to be advocating foreign gods, 18b, they said this because Paul was preaching the gospel about Jesus and the resurrection. He was preaching the good news. And for Paul, that centers on the cross. It always has. It always will. So in other words, Paul was regularly preaching Jesus and Jesus crucified and Jesus resurrected from the dead in the marketplace. So you can be jolly sure that when he's challenged to do so again in this context, that's where he was heading. Now, whether you get there by starting off with Jesus' life and going through the through his death to his resurrection, or you start with a picture of the final judgment and then come to the resurrection and go back to the passion, that's indifferent. But he was interrupted before he got as far as he wanted to get. Number five, you have to remember that at this juncture in his ministry, Paul wasn't a rookie. It's not as if he was some recent graduate from the Irish Baptist College. Still, though, a good chap, but a wee bit wet behind the ears. And perhaps a little fearful of what people might think, and therefore trimming his theology just a wee bit because he was nervous. Nope, he's been in this business now for 20 years. And during that time, he's been beaten up and stoned and shipwrecked. He's been laughed at. He's been left for dead. He's been in prison. He's thought about these things. He's written already some of his most important books. He's not a rookie who gets a little nervous because of a few intellectuals. In fact, far from being nervous when he comes into Athens, he's already dismissing the idolatry and grieved by it. Did you see? So to imagine that Paul, after 20 years of serious ministry, has a slight brain misplacement and makes a mistake that a rookie shouldn't make is really condescending toward the apostle. Next, number six, it's important to see that 1 Corinthians 2, where Paul does say, I resolved to know nothing when I was with you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. Where Paul says that in 1 Corinthians 2, he does not cast his comment over against what he did in Athens. He does not say in 1 Corinthians 2, of course, when I was in Athens, I made a mistake, but once I got to your place, I resolved to know nothing among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified. Rather, in 1 Corinthians 2, he casts his comments, his resolution to preach Christ and Christ crucified, over against the rhetorical tradition of Corinth. Namely, the tradition that says, how you say things is more important than what you say. You must impress people with your eloquence. You must show that you understand Aristotle and Quintilian. You must display these things and be admired, or else people will not come to listen to you. It's over against that tradition that he says, I resolved to know nothing among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified. I was not out to impress, save to impress you with Jesus Christ and the cross. Do you see? So to interpret 1 Corinthians 2 against the background of what happened in Athens is without warrant, not only in Acts, but it's without warrant in 1 Corinthians 2. Moreover, in any case, in 2 Corinthians 10, written after this, sometime later, Paul is still of the opinion that it is important to bring every thought into obedience to Christ. Paul's grasp of the gospel does not mean that he is thoughtless or somehow suspicious of what we would call worldview formation, what he would call philosophy. Elsewhere, he speaks against philosophies that don't have Christ, but the very fact that he wants every thought to be obedient to Christ shows that he is interested in what we call worldview formation. In that passage in 2 Corinthians, where he speaks of bringing every thought into captivity, into obedience to Christ, he is not saying, therefore stop watching pornography. Rather, make your thoughts holy. Undoubtedly, he would say that, but that's not his point. His point in that context is not cast aside dirty thoughts. It's cast aside wrong thoughts. Cast aside misplaced thoughts. Cast aside thoughts that construct a worldview that is not God-centered and grounded in the revelation that God himself has given. So Paul, in other words, is interested in worldview formation. From the beginning, he understands that being obedient to Jesus Christ is bound up with bringing every thought into captivity. And finally, it's worth reflecting for a moment on verse 34. Some of the people became followers of Paul and believed. Among them was Dionysius, a member of the Areopagus, also a woman named Damaris, and a number of others. You see, some people interpret that verse to say that a handful of people did become Christians on the spot. Some people became followers of Paul and believed. I don't think that's what it's saying at all. I think it's saying something like, some people became followers of Paul. And in consequence, they got more gospel, they got more discipleship, they got more evangelism, they got more training, and eventually came to believe. When I started doing university missions 35 or 40 years ago, the people who got converted at them would tend to get converted during the mission. Some would get converted afterwards, but they tended to get converted during the mission. And when you go back even earlier to when I was in university myself as an undergraduate studying chemistry in the mid-60s, that's when I first heard Dick Lucas preach evangelistically at McGill University. That's when I first heard Dave McKinnon and others. I mean, that was my first exposure to university missions, but I was on the intervarsity side, as it was, the UCCF side, trying to work at these things. It was wonderful to watch a young Dick Lucas preaching the gospel at McGill University. I was entranced by the way he could communicate with them, do you see? And people got converted during the mission. But that tends not to be the way it happens today. People are so far away, they are so alien, their world views, their categories of thought, their essential idolatries, their ways of looking at things are so far removed from a biblical framework that it takes time to build the structures in which Jesus alone makes sense. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm perfectly aware that God in His sovereignty can reach down into the most biblically illiterate and save them in 15 minutes if He wants to. But normally, God is a God of means. And so part of evangelism, when you're evangelizing tribes that are pre-Stone Age in their technology in the jungles of Papua New Guinea, is building up the Bible storyline until you've got a context in which talking about Jesus makes sense. Do you see? Now, I know God is capable of bringing revival in 15 minutes to the jungles of Papua New Guinea, or to the jungles of Belfast, for that matter. But God is normally a God of means. And the more ignorant people are, the more alien they are, the more removed they are from a Christian frame of reference in which alone Jesus makes sense, then the more time it takes to build some of those structures up, do you see? And so today, it's not uncommon after 5 days of meetings and a university mission to have seen nobody converted, or maybe one or two. Not uncommon. But to get a whole lot of them signed up for a Christianity Explained or a Christianity Explored course or the like, or some other course, Read, Mark, Learn, or one of the others. You choose your poison. There are lots of them around. And then over the next 6, 8, 10 weeks, you get emails from those who have been left behind in the university saying, do you remember that Chinese lass, you know, that you talked to after a meeting for about 2 hours? She's come through now. She's a Christian. And you just get email after email like that as people are converted. In other words, they become followers of Don and believed. Just as in this case, they became followers of Paul and believed. Not in some sort of a clannish sense or the like. That's what's going on here. Do you see? They like what this man had to say, so they attached themselves to him and found out more about it and then subsequently believed. So far from being a failure here, he shows that he's serious about this business of evangelizing people with alien worldviews. Now, that was really by way of excursus. But it was part of my point, the priorities that Paul adopts. That is the primacy of preaching to those with a shared heritage. And we know how he does that by looking at a passage like Acts 13. And the urgency of preaching to those with an alien heritage, we're about to find out how he does that by looking at the verses immediately in front of us. And now we come to the framework that Paul establishes. I'm going to start that, and then we'll break for coffee in a few minutes, and we'll come back to it after the break. And then after that, we'll talk about the non-negotiable gospel Paul preaches, then some practical points, and throw it open to Q&A. So that's where we're heading, if you're wondering if I do have anything structured. So the framework Paul establishes. He's challenged. You're bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we would like to know what they mean. All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Sounds like a lot of senior common rooms I visited. So Paul now stands up in the meeting of the Areopagus and he says, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious." Nobody would say that today. What they'd say today is, "I see that you're a very spiritual people." Today in the Western world, being religious is out. Being spiritual is in. Mind you, it's pretty ill-defined. I've had people say to me, "I don't mind if you have your Christian spirituality, you know, centered on Jesus. For me, I'm quite a spiritual person too. For me, it's crystals. You know, I really like the vibration from crystals. It really helps me, calms me down, gives me a lot of serenity. Like you, I'm quite a spiritual person." For spirituality today has come to mean something vague like not merely a mechanical robot bound up with atoms and matter and space and time and nothing more. There's a dimension to me of life or something that has some spark and energy and is interested in the paranormal and the other and so on. And whether that's tied up with organized religion or not makes no difference at all. So the very multiplicity of the gods meant that Paul could see these people as very, we would say, spiritual. He would say, religious. So he's starting off with a gentle encouragement, trying to find common ground, making sense to them. He doesn't come in thundering with the wrath of God just yet. That's coming. "I see that in every way you are very religious, for as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship..." Oh, that's clever. He doesn't want to say, "and looked carefully at your gods." He doesn't think they're gods. He doesn't want to say, "quite yet, and looked carefully at your idols," because they don't think of them as idols. They think of them as gods. So he uses a neutral term, "and looked around at your objects of worship." You see, he wants to be faithful to his own understanding of where the truth lies, but he doesn't want to be needlessly insulting. But on the other hand, in bending over backwards to communicate well, he doesn't want to use their categories if by using their categories he's going to confirm them in their views. He is about to dismiss their gods, but he doesn't want to do so in the very first breath. He's getting there. He's getting there. "I looked around, I carefully saw your objects of worship. I even found an altar with this inscription, 'to an unknown God.'" That hasn't shown up archaeologically, but there's no reason whatsoever to doubt that there was something like that. The point is, the gods had various domains. So, if you're going to make a sea voyage to Rome, then you want to offer a sacrifice to Neptune, the god of the sea. The idea in pagan religion, all these gods were finite with their various domains. They have their needs, you have your needs. You scratch their back, they scratch your back. It's a tit-for-tat arrangement. All paganism is a kind of swap theology. And these gods have their various domains. So you offer some sacrifices to Neptune, and then when you get there, you're supposed to give a speech to the Roman Senate. So you want to offer sacrifices to the god of communication, who is Mercury in the Latin world. You offer your sacrifice in the hope of having a good communication. And meanwhile, you're courting your love. So something's got to go off to Venus or Aphrodite, depending on whether you're in the Greek world or the Roman world. Do you see? They all have their domains. But there are so many, many domains. Maybe you left a god out by mistake. You could get snookered just because you forgot a god and thus implicitly insulted him or her. So some bright spark erected an altar to an unknown god just to sort of cover the bases. That's what it looks like. But what this altar does for Paul is signal their fundamental ignorance of God. So he says, So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship. And this is what I'm going to proclaim to you. Can you imagine the electricity in the room at that point? One of the things you have to do when you are trying to evangelize people with an alien worldview is understand their worldview better than they do themselves. And then answer it. You can't begin by condescending dismissal, because they will read that as lack of respect. One of the great things that Tim Keller does in his books on homiletic, on apologetics, and in his university missions, he recently did the university mission at Oxford at OIQ, is describe the other person's position better than the other person can himself. And then destroy it and replace it with the gospel. So now he's announced what he's going to do and why he's going to do it, and he begins. Now, what you must recognize at this juncture is that every clause here would be a point in his sermon. There's no way that his entire address was finished in about 2 minutes, which is what it takes you to read it. Areopagus addresses were known to go on for hours. And in most cases, you could be reasonably sure of what Paul would have actually said, how he would have fleshed it out, because somewhere in his writings, or in his allusions to the Old Testament, you can see that he does develop these very themes elsewhere. So you must see that these particular points are mere headings in his sermon. But then, within that framework, you can flesh out the sermon content from the headings. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by human hands. He's established three or four huge truths in one sentence. Number one, a sovereign creator God who made everything. That's Isaiah. That's Genesis. That's some of the Psalms. That's Romans 1. For at the end of the day, all of human accountability is grounded in the doctrine of creation. If someone begins to say to you, I don't mind that you follow your Jesus. We all have our modes of spirituality. But I don't like you shoving your Jesus down my throat. And I wish you'd back off just a wee bit. Because I'm not sure I want your friendship if you don't. What do you say? Well, it may be the part of grace and wisdom to back off a little. You don't want to be rude. And you want to establish and continue the links with another human being made in the image of God. But sooner or later, don't you have to say something like this? I really don't mean to offend you. I'm sorry if I've sounded rude or condescending. Christians should never be rude and condescending, because we know we're nothing more than poor beggars telling other poor beggars where there's bread. But the one thing I can't do is back off. Because God made you, and therefore you owe Him. And you will give an account to Him. Sooner or later, don't we have to say something like that? You see, the grounding of all human responsibility before God is, in fact, the doctrine of creation. And derivatively, as we'll see in a moment, the doctrine of God's ongoing providence. In Him we live and move and have our being. In Him we have every breath that we breathe. Not only is God the maker of all, we're told that he is the Lord of heaven and earth. So, some forms of Greco-Roman thought, not all forms, thought that the gods lived in the spiritual domains. In the Epicureans' case, in atoms so fine that they hid in the interstices between the atoms of the larger created order, the material order. Other forms of Greco-Roman thought that there was originally a god or gods who created other gods and then lesser gods, all the way down to what was called a demiurgos, a demiurge, a lower god that finally made it matter. Because the ultimate high gods wouldn't sully their hands with matter. Paul doesn't think like that. There's one God who made everything and continues to rule over everything in heaven and earth. But if you have time to tease that out, that means there's nothing intrinsically wrong with matter. God made it. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with flesh. God made it. There's nothing intrinsically superior to what is spirit as opposed to what is matter. God made both. And God's ongoing providential care watches over both. If a raindrop falls, it's under God's sanction and sovereignty. And if the Spirit moves you to admire something lovely and good, that's under God's sovereignty too. It's an entirely different worldview. Do you see? This is bound up with worldview formation. Moreover, he does not live in temples built by human hands. Of course, Paul is a Jew. He knows about the tabernacle. He knows about Solomon's temple. He knows about the rebuilding of the temple. He knows about the rebuilding of the rebuilding under Herod. He knows all about that. In some sense or other, God does live in temples built by human hands. But after all, when Solomon dedicates the temple in Jerusalem, his prayer includes magnificent lines like, "Behold, the heaven of heavens cannot contain you. How much less this house that I have built." So in biblical thought, the temple is not the place where God is located, such that he is not located somewhere else. If I fly to the morning, if I descend to Sheol, even there your spirit finds me. Do you see? He's not limited. The problem is that in pagan thought, not only were the gods localized, it was through the temples that the gods were domesticated. It was at the temple that you had priestly classes to offer the right sacrifice to get the right blessing from the right god. That's the way it worked. Over against that way of viewing temples, Paul wants these people to realize that God outstrips temples. He's not domesticated. He's not localized. He's not a Greek god as opposed to a Roman god. He's not a Jewish god as opposed to a Greco-Roman god. He's God, God. So once again, you're involved in worldview formation and beginning to adopt a vision of God that is massive. It's huge. It's constraining. It's threatening. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Now, this is directly combating the common view in paganism that pagan religion, at the end of the day, involved a tit-for-tat arrangement. You scratch my back, I scratch your back. The gods have their needs, and we have our needs, and what religion does is bring the needs together in some negotiated way such that the gods get their praise, they get their sacrifices, the priests get their money, the temples are built up, and the gods are glorified, and meanwhile you get your fat baby or whatever it is you're looking for. Did you see? But supposing you're dealing with a God who doesn't need a thing. Not a blessed thing. You've got nothing to trade. That means you've got to be dealt with out of his grace, or you are not dealt with at all. You see, that lesson was already taught clearly in the Old Testament. Over against all the ancient gods of the ancient Near East, with their various foci and interests and lasciviousness and ups and downs and domains. Israel is told in Deuteronomy 6, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength." Do you see what Jesus calls the greatest command, the command to love God with heart and soul and mind and strength, is, at the end of the day, possible, conceivable, and ultimately mandated on the assumption of monotheism. If there are lots of gods, it's idiotic to love any one of them with heart and soul and mind and strength, because you've got to scatter your devotion and allegiance to cover all the bases. But if there's one God who doesn't need anything, then he demands the devotion of heart and soul and mind and strength. He demands it. And you can't trade anything with him because he doesn't need anything. The Puritans had a word for this. We've largely lost it. Aseity. He's not only the God of omnipotence and the God of holiness and the God of omniscience and the God of truthfulness. He's the God of aseity. A-S-E-I-T-Y. It's from the Latin a se, which means from himself. He is so much of himself, from himself, that he's dependent on no other. So God doesn't arrive at Thursday afternoon and say, "Oh, I can hardly wait till Sunday when they break out those guitars and start singing my praises again. I'm so lonely up here. It'd be nice to be stroked." He doesn't need our praises. Not even if you upgrade them to pipe organs. In eternity past, God was entirely content. He never did need us. In eternity past, the Father loved the Son, and the Son loved the Father. Perfection loving perfection. One being, three persons. In spectacular, holy, loving, righteous contentment. He's the God of aseity. Some medieval hymns get this right. We don't sing things like this today. "Thou wast, O God, and thou wast blessed before the world began. Of thine eternity possessed before time's hourglass ran. Thou needest none thy praise to sing, as if thy joy could fade. Couldst thou have needed anything, thou couldst have nothing made." Do you hear that? If God had been the sort of God that needed stuff, he wouldn't have been the sort of God that could have made stuff. Now, don't misunderstand. This does not back God into a corner so that he becomes a deistic God. The text is not denying that God interacts with us, that God wants us, that God commands us, that God expects certain things and responds to us personally. He's not only the God of aseity, he's the personal God. But if he's the personal God that wants things, including he expects to be worshipped for reasons we can't go into now, you can pick it up later in Q&A, why he expects to be worshipped, it's not because there is some intrinsic lack in himself so he needs it. He doesn't need it. That's what the text says, explicitly. It's one of the things that you have to say with pagans, whose gods are all finite and limited. You've got to make clear that's not what God is like. That's an unknown God. The text says explicitly, he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Period. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. Now you're dealing not only with God as creator, but you're dealing with God as providential sustainer. Every breath you breathe in this hall today is by his sanction. And your heart is still clicking along. you live. And if God says stop, you're dead. That's not a deistic God. That's a sovereign, providential, personal God. Now we'll stop for coffee before we press on with the kinds of things that Paul establishes and the framework that he sets out.